From NPR News in Washington, this is special coverage of the United States Supreme Court. I'm Linda Wertheimer. This week, the court concluded the current term with decisions on three major issues: affirmative action, voting rights, and gay marriage. Over the next hour, we're going to talk about all three cases. We have in our studio NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, senior Washington editor Ron Elving, Tom Goldstein of SCOTUS blog, and from Seattle, correspondent Wendy Kaufman joins us. From NPR West in Culver City, we have Michael Fauntroy, associate professor of political science at Howard University. We're going to begin at the end, the last day of the session, and two long-awaited decisions on gay marriage. First, the challenge to the Defense of Marriage Act, called DOMA. DOMA prohibited same-sex married couples from receiving the same benefits as other married couples. The other case was a challenge to California's Proposition 8, which said that only marriage between a man and a woman is recognized in California. Hundreds of people gathered in front of the Supreme Court for the decisions. Newlyweds Michael Margolis Constantino and Shalom Constantino were part of that crowd at the Supreme Court today, and they were thrilled about the DOMA decision.
Oh,
I think we were both moved to tears there. It means an extraordinary amount to us personally. Shalom is a foreign national, and the hurdles that we have had to go through in order to keep ourselves united here when we live in the United States are tremendous, and this ruling now means that I can transmit an immigration benefit to him, that the federal government will recognize our marriage as a true and real marriage on par with everybody else's marriages, and it will affect us tremendously and our ability to lead secure, happy, safe lives.
Across the country, in City Hall in San Francisco, City Attorney Dennis Herrera and other politicians gathered to celebrate the end of Proposition 8. Herrera was part of the legal fight in California against Prop 8.
We would not be here today if it wasn't for the community. Getting out, talking to people, educating, helping us change the hearts and minds of people throughout this country. So we had a great victory at the Supreme Court today because we will once again have marriage equality here in California, and the discriminatory Proposition 8 is struck from the ledger. Now, I can tell you also that you already hear some proponents talking about how they're going to go and continue to litigate this. We already have the motions drafted. We're ready to go back into court again. And we will fight as long as it takes to not just have marriage equality here in California, but recognizing that it is one more brick in the wall, and we will not rest until we have marriage equality throughout this country.
Back in Washington, some who stood outside the Supreme Court were disappointed. Jennifer Kearns was the spokesperson for Proposition 8.
I'm here today on behalf of the 7 million voters in the state of California who voted for Proposition 8. I am here today because the state of California has a system of direct democracy. More than 7 million voters voted for Proposition 8 in 2008, and more than 10 million voters in the mid-1990s voted for Proposition 22. While I have been quiet for the last 5 years, for this proposition to take its course in our legal system, I'm here today on behalf of the 7 million voters in the state of California to express our disappointment. We believe that every vote should count. Thank you.
Some Republican lawmakers also registered their disappointment at both the gay marriage decisions. Doug LaMalfa from California's 1st District said the court's decision on Prop 8 debases marriage and discourages voters.
When you're out there on the street and you're talking to people, or you're campaigning, going to door to door, a decision like this makes the people's voice muted and people say, why should I even vote? Because a court's going to wipe away the decision I've made. And so that takes away the faith people have even in the system, as well as when they see their elected officials, like an attorney general in California, that refused, because of politics, to defend what the people had done. Not once, but twice in California, Prop 22 before and then Prop 8 more recently. When politics enters into it and they say, we're not going to defend what the people have to say, then they find out that they have no standing in court because no one will stand for them. They don't have the right legalities. Their faith is completely eroded in the process. So this is a very bad decision for families and as well as the legal process and the voters, the people's faith in their government. So where do we go from here? I don't know. I don't think it ends here because I believe that they won't be satisfied with this decision. They will now want to go on and force their way into people's religious freedoms and see that churches may have to perform things that they're against within their institutions. And so I don't know where it does end, but I do know it's a sad day for America.
Now, to talk about what happened at the court, we're going to turn first to NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Nina, we're sort of lumping both these decisions under the rubric of gay marriage, but what actually was at issue in these two cases?
Well, the DOMA case is a statute. Defense of Marriage Act is a statute. And it said, we won't recognize the laws of the individual states that may legalize gay marriage, that even though these couples are legally married in these states, we don't recognize those marriages for purposes of federal benefits, whether it's can you be buried in a cemetery for veterans or your Social Security survival benefits. And the court today, by a 5-4 vote, struck that down as unconstitutional discrimination. Justice Kennedy, writing for the five justices, said that by refusing to acknowledge the married status of same-sex couples in states where these unions are legal, DOMA tells everyone, including the couple's own children, that their marriages are less worthy than the marriages of others, and that, therefore, the law can't stand. The other case, the California case, involved Proposition 8, which bans same-sex marriage, but it's a much more difficult legal question. Who can challenge, who can appeal a case when the people who challenged Prop 8 won in the lower courts? Well, who can then appeal that? And the state's officials said, we're not going to appeal it. We actually think the lower courts were right. We're not going to appeal it. It was a Republican governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and then later a Republican governor, Jerry Brown, who said, we're not going to appeal it. And the Supreme Court... Democratic governor, Jerry Brown. And the Supreme Court, in a very different coalition of justices, said, well, we don't have a live controversy here. It's the state that can appeal something like this, not individual citizens. You can't substitute somebody for the state. Goodbye case.
So goodbye case. Tom Goldstein, tell me what that means for the state of California, the people of California. What happens?
Well, this could be a pretty significant non-decision, if you will. The Supreme Court refused to decide the big question in the case, which is there a constitutional right to same-sex marriage? They wanted really nothing to do with deciding this at a moment when it's really a big social transition and a lot of states are tackling that question. So what does it mean in California? Well, what it means is, as a practical matter, if you're a same-sex couple in California, you're going to be able to get married. Now, you're not going to be, that this ruling isn't going to affect other states directly, but within the time that it takes for the legal process to continue in this case, there are just a few little T's to cross and I's to dot, 30 to 45 days. In California, the governor has made clear that he wants the county clerks to make same-sex marriage available. Now, some county clerks may refuse and say, I'm going to follow Proposition 8, but we do know that there are a lot of clerks out there that will give out these licenses.
So marriage licenses are likely to be available in California very soon?
Very soon. As a purely technical matter, it takes 25 days for the Supreme Court's decision to take effect, and then the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that had the case before has to dissolve a stay. In theory, actually, a county clerk tomorrow in California, because he's not subject to any court injunction, could decide to recognize same-sex marriage. But I think everybody here has decided to take this just a bit slow and put a process in place. So 30 days is a good estimate.
So does this ruling, the two of you, does this ruling, do you think, send any kind of signal to states that have banned gay marriage, Nina?
You know, there are, you can read this a little bit round or flat. I think the impetus really is for the side that says we want to recognize same-sex marriage, because there's lots of language in Justice Kennedy's opinion. He's likely the fifth and deciding vote, if we ever get to the ultimate question in the Supreme Court, that suggests equality. But there are lots of comments in his dissent in the other case that seem to suggest, look, if people want to have a referendum and vote against this, we ought to defer to that. So you can read this really both ways. We still don't know where there are five votes. Is it for a same-sex right to marry or not? Tommy, do you disagree?
No. What I would say is that in the Supreme Court, like on the radio, sometimes you have to listen to the music and not the individual notes. And what you have here maybe is, rather than a legal push from the Supreme Court, a moral push. When Justice Kennedy's opinion in the DOMA case talks about the legal dignity of a same-sex marriage, what he's doing is he's putting same-sex couples on the same level playing field with other couples. And it's sending a message, not that I think that states as a legal matter have to recognize same-sex marriage, but perhaps in some way that they should. And the Supreme Court is a moral leader one way or other, the other in the country. And undecided individuals, it's not going to make a big difference in the Deep South. That's a lot more conservative. But there are other parts in the country that are probably listening.
It does seem. I mean, if you look at the if you look at the basis on which Justice Kennedy writes his opinion, it's equal treatment. That all citizens are equal to one another. That if you give benefits to one set of people who are legally married, you must give them to another set of people who are legally married. I mean, it's that simple in Kennedy's opinion, isn't it?
It is, in his opinion, but his opinion is really about the Defense of Marriage Act. It's about federal benefits. There's the rest of the second half of this issue is about constitutional right. And so I agree with Tommy about the music versus the notes, but I think we've got to hear a few more notes before we know what the theme is.
NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, Tom Goldstein, the publisher of SCOTUS Blog. We'll be back in just a few minutes. You're listening to special coverage of the Supreme Court from NPR News. From NPR News in Washington, this is special coverage of the United States Supreme Court. I'm Linda Wertheimer. We are summing up the final week of the court's term. On the last day, the court struck down an important part of the Defense of Marriage Act, one of two significant rulings on gay marriage. The DOMA case, the court heard, concerned a New York couple, Edith Windsor and Thea Speier. They were together for 42 years prior to their marriage in 2007. When Speier died, however, Windsor found she owed $363,000 in estate taxes that she would not have had to pay if her spouse had been of the opposite sex. Edith Windsor spoke today in New York.
To all of the gay people and their supporters who have cheered me on, thank you, thank you, thank you. Okay, I'm sure Thea is thanking you too. Not only does a much larger portion of our country, of our straight and the straight members of our country, see us differently, okay, as just people who live and love and bring up kids who will play with their kids, but our own community has come out and seen each other and loved each other in a way that makes me courageous and proud and joyous every day. Because of today's Supreme Court ruling, the federal government can no longer discriminate against the marriages of gay and lesbian Americans. Children born today will grow up in a world without DOMA. And those same children who happen to be gay will be free to love and get married, as Thea and I did, but with the same federal benefits, protections, and dignity as everyone else. If I had to survive Thea, what a glorious way to do it. And she would be so pleased. Thank you all.
Many businesses were pleased with the DOMA decision. Jack Christen Jr. is Associate General Counsel for eBay. eBay has more than 30,000 employees. And it was one of the companies that signed on to an amicus brief to overturn DOMA. Christen is happy about the decision since it means more consistency for companies.
Everything from family medical leave to retirement benefits, to the way retirement benefits are taxed, to the way health benefits are taxed, all of those extremely important employee benefits that companies like eBay provide to their employees would all be impacted in a very positive way, in that lawfully married people who work at all the companies that signed on to the brief would be treated exactly the same as their colleagues who were married to somebody of a different gender.
Wendy Kaufman joins us from Seattle. Wendy covers business, among the many other things she does. Wendy, first of all, let me just ask you, why companies like eBay, Apple, Walt Disney, Amazon, why would they think that overturning DOMA would be good for business?
It's both a matter of principle and a matter of dollars and cents. On the principle side, there was a feeling among a lot of them, and I should say that about 200 major companies and firms signed on to a brief to overturn DOMA. They basically felt they were having to treat their same-sex couples differently than their married couples, and they didn't like it. They felt like they were agents of discrimination, if you will. So that was the moral side. On the dollars and cents side, they basically had to have two sets of books for some of their employees. So on the one hand, they were considered married in the eyes of their state, but they were considered single in the eyes of the federal government, and it made accounting and bookkeeping incredibly complicated and convoluted. I'm going to just give you one example. Health insurance, for example, benefits that are paid for by an employer are not taxable if you give those to a spouse. So if your spouse gets employee benefits that, say, eBay pays for, you don't pay taxes on it. But if you're part of a same-sex couple, the federal government required that you pay taxes. They saw that as imputed income. And so what eBay would do, and a lot of other companies did this too, is they would pay the employees money to cover the taxes that they had to pay to cover their health insurance. So eBay basically sends its employees two checks, its same-sex couples two checks, one for salary and benefits, and another one to cover the taxes. So it's an incredibly complicated, expensive, convoluted process, and they just didn't want to do it.
Now, the decision on DOMA, which says that gay couples are now eligible for federal benefits, what does that mean for a couple who perhaps was married in Maryland, where same-sex marriage is legal, and living in Virginia, where it is not legal?
It's going to be a very interesting thing to sort all that out. There are perhaps as many as 1,000 regulations and rules that are going to have to be changed. It's for this to take full effect. It's not clear how far the administration and Congress in some cases are going to push to make some of these administrative changes. So we're really not sure how all that's going to play out. Another place that where there's still a little bit of uncertainty is on income taxes.
Hold on. Wendy?
I actually spent some time asking these questions today. The Justice Department is probably going to be the lead on this, but all of these different agencies are going to put out regulations relatively quickly. And I think the Obama administration, after all, favors same-sex marriage, and you're going to see a fairly broad interpretation of what's tolerable. If you, for example, if you've been married in New York and you're transferred to Alabama, where it's clearly where same-sex marriage is clearly not legal, I think the likelihood is that your same-sex marriage will be recognized nonetheless by the federal government in terms of what kind of taxes you file, Social Security benefits, all kinds of other things like that. Perhaps the hardest case everybody seems to think is the example of somebody who gets on a plane, goes to New York to get married, then goes back to Alabama, and that is not. I think nobody's quite sure how they're going to handle that. But I think everybody is pretty much anticipating, as you already heard in the newscast, for example, that immigration statuses will be changed because of this, because if you're married to somebody from a foreign country, you now are able to claim that person as a spouse. The Department of Homeland Security has already now, within hours of this decision, made that ruling. And I think this is not going to be as long and difficult as you think. I think it's going to be fairly quick and fairly precise from the administration with a few unironed out wrinkles.
Wendy, you wanted to talk about federal income taxes?
I was going to just – I will say, Nina, that I'm sure that all the married couples, same-sex couples I talked to today are going to be excited to hear what you just said. I was just going to briefly talk about income tax. For a lot of same-sex couples, this is going to make a big difference, and they're going to end up paying a lot less income tax. For example, that could range from anywhere from a few $100s, a few $1,000s to, I talked to someone today who's counseling a couple that's going to save $96,000 in a single year by being able to file as a married couple. So that's going to be a huge savings for a lot of people.
Now, the Justice Kennedy wrote for the majority in overturning the Defense of Marriage Act, and the decision was 5-4. And Justice Kennedy actually played the role of the swing voter, which in the previous court he played fairly frequently, but has not in quite the same way this time. What do you think about Justice Kennedy writing this decision, being the swing voter, siding with the liberal part of the court?
Everybody thought that Kennedy would be the swing voter in this case. I mean, he's written all the previous big decisions on issues of gay rights. He has been the pioneer in this area. And so although the opinion almost certainly was assigned by Justice Ginsburg, she assigned it to him because he's the likely contender, as they say.
And from San Francisco, is that right?
Indeed. Well, Sacramento.
From Sacramento. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's a Californian.
A Northern Californian.
But dissented in the California case.
Now, in his dissent in the DOMA case, Justice Scalia argued that the majority opinion paves the way for supporters of gay marriage to challenge state laws denying the institution of marriage for same-sex couples. Perhaps I'm conflating that with Prop 8. No.
No, you've got it exactly.
You've got right.
Yeah, exactly. And so the question is, where we go from here? Mm-hmm. Is he right? Is it going to be the next round of litigation? And here, gay rights, LGBT rights advocates have a real puzzle on their hands and a dilemma, and that is that they are winning in some very significant sense where it matters, and that's on the ground. State after state after state, they are turning them around. And that's because they haven't had a real big setback lately, and they might have dodged a bullet by not getting a ruling from the Supreme Court in the Proposition 8 case. Who knows what the justices would have done with that one? So they will be sorely tempted to keep up that momentum with voters and with state legislatures and get same-sex marriage recognized that way. And the problem is going to be they struck liquid gold in California with the trial judge ruling in this case recognizing a right to same-sex marriage. And if there's litigation in a place like Alabama or Texas or Louisiana, it could go the other way. And the real problem for gay rights advocates is they don't actually have control. Anybody can go into court and claim that this right exists, and they can't stop the lawsuits from going forward. So every single day for them is a dilemma.
And there is a case already. There are two cases in the pipeline, one from Nevada, one from Hawaii. Hawaii conceivably could adopt same-sex marriage as legal, but I think it's highly unlikely in Nevada, and they're already at the appeals court level there. So we're looking at 1, 2, maybe 3 years in all likelihood before the next one of these cases makes it to the Supreme Court.
Justice Scalia also described the majority opinion as jaw-dropping and went on to be very critical of the majority for standing in the way of the will of Congress in the DOMA Act, the will of the people in California in Prop 8. Justice Scalia has not been all that deferential to Congress in this past.
Yeah, we're going to talk in a few minutes about this thing called the Voting Rights Act, but that was the day before. So history moves quickly at the Supreme Court. Justice Scalia has a way with words, as we know. He could be on the radio. He has an extraordinarily evocative way of putting things, and clearly he believes that the Supreme Court has interjected itself into a social war that it has no business in.
Although I will say this for him. He predicted several years ago when he was in dissent in one of these gay rights cases that we would soon be looking at claims for same-sex marriage. And at the time, this was 10 years ago, I thought that was a little
People
crazy.
Laughed.
I thought that was a little crazy. He's been right on this all along. And if he's a trend spotter, he's spotting a trend again.
Okay. I want to bring Michael Fauntroy of Howard University in, from Howard University, but in California at the moment.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Fauntroy, there really has been a sea change in public opinion on gay marriage in just the last few years. Do you think that that recognition of the people going the way that people seem to be going, according to polling and whatnot, is that at work here?
I think the court insiders would probably tell you no, but it's hard to see otherwise. You know, in many ways, the court is a lagging indicator of public opinion. Think about Brown, Baker versus Carr, Shelley versus Kramer, Loving versus Virginia in some respects. And so, you can't help but think that. And I would also add, I'm concerned or would be interested to know the extent to which personal relationships may play a role. When you think about the evolution of public opinion, that a lot of that has to do with the reality that millions upon millions of Americans have gay relatives, friends, and coworkers. And at some point, many of them have just sort of said, what's the big deal? And many of them have just accepted the reality of gay marriage. And so when you think about it in those terms, it's hard to see how public opinion could not have played at least some role in influencing or at least solidifying the decisions on one side or the other.
Do you think this might come back in the midterm elections in 2014 or the presidential election in 2016 raised as an issue?
Oh, well, Linda, I think the 2014 midterms just started yesterday. Think about this for a second. You have a number of super PAC contributors who've been on the sidelines since the November elections, sort of frustrated that the millions they spent didn't have the intended impact. But now that this issue has come up, and we're going to talk a little later about the voting rights case, I think it will prove to be too difficult for many to resist, sort of really pushing to get some things done to try to capture Congress and move in one direction or the other. So I think we're going to see it next year for sure, and certainly by 2016, depending, of course, who the nominees will be, it's likely to also play a role. As Nina just mentioned, it could be 1, 2, or 3 years before another case gets to the court. Well, that could be 2016 when we're talking about a presidential election.
So it'll land right at the right time to have an effect. Ron Elving, What do you think? The Republican leadership in the House, of course, supported the Defense of Marriage Act. Now they're saying that they hope the states will decide to define marriage as a union between a man and a woman. Are they punting to the states?
They already did. They really didn't come out very strongly as a force in this whole consideration of DOMA. They did finance the support of it, but they didn't really show the flag very often or very strongly. And, there have already been a handful of people who have come over in the House and in the Senate. I wouldn't be expecting any kind of a tsunami in that respect. I don't think there'll be an enormous number of Republicans changing their minds, although some may around the country, and some of those may be office holders. I wouldn't look for that in the Congress. We've only got 3 senators who have come out in favor of gay marriage. Rob Portman, famously from Ohio, was first, then Mark Kirk from Illinois, and then Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, probably all states where it would make a certain amount more sense than the Deep South or some of the other parts of the country. And of a list of 184 people in the House who have come out for gay marriage, I only have found one Republican, Ileana Ross Luttinen from Florida. There may be others. If there are others, I'm sure I'll learn of them very soon. But that's not very many out of 184. So that's obviously not very many out of 230-some Republicans in the House. And as you heard earlier, and I think that was the preponderance of comment from the Republicans in the House and Senate today, they were extremely upset at today's ruling.
Now, I think we ought to just move on to the Voting Rights Act, which was another huge decision, which, Nina, you said, cuts the heart out of the Voting Rights Act, this decision, by taking pre-clearance away. Could you just explain how that should work in a fairly concise fashion?
Well, the Voting Rights Act, really the key provision of the Voting Rights Act, there is another big section, but the key provision basically was aimed at mainly southern jurisdictions that used to play rope-a-dope with minorities. Okay, you knock off one discriminatory practice and we'll lose in the courts, then we adopt another one. So Congress conceived of this idea that these areas that have been guilty of discrimination in the past should have to pre-clear in advance any changes in their voting procedures so that there's no more rope-a-dope. And in order to do that, they made this formula for which areas were covered. Well, that made a certain amount of sense in 1965, but they haven't updated it since 1975. Congress renewed the act in 2006 and said, we've looked at it. We still think it's a reasonable formula. And they kept it. Well, the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 vote, said, we don't think it's a reasonable formula anymore. It's not current. And we're striking it down. And I'm sure that if we had John Roberts sitting here, he would say, look, they can redo the formula anytime they want. But we all know that's not really going to happen. And the bottom line is that it really does cut the heart out of the Voting Rights Act. The whole concept of preclearance is gone.
As excuse me. Ron Elving, what do you think about the possibility that the Congress might decide to rewrite portions of the Voting Rights Act, maybe reinstate preclearance?
Many people in Congress would like to do that, but it's not going to happen because it's simply too difficult to put it over on those who don't want it to happen. The 16 states that are affected by preclearance, 9 entire states and parts of 7 others, they don't make up a majority of the country, but they're pretty close to making up half of the Republican seats in the House. And that's enough right there. You do not have the same dynamic of some Republicans being willing to really wade in on the side of this that you had in 65 and that you had in 1975. It's a very different Republican Party in the House these days, and they're not going to do it. And they knew that in 2006, and that's how they essentially reached the deal to renew the act without renewing the formula, risking the ire of the Supreme Court, as they knew they would do.
Michael Fauntroy, what do you think about the assertion from the bench that the Voting Rights Act has done its job?
Well, it has done its job, but that doesn't mean it doesn't continue to be necessary. You know, when you think about what has gone on just in the last couple of years with the number of states that have put in discriminatory voting practices, it's clear that it's still necessary.
Thank you very much. You're listening to special coverage of the Supreme Court from NPR News. From NPR News in Washington, this is special coverage of the United States Supreme Court. I'm Linda Wertheimer. We're talking about the end of the Supreme Court's term, the Voting Rights Act, and the court's decision to strike down a key provision. Writing for the majority, Chief Justice Roberts observed that the country has changed dramatically over the past 50 years, yet Congress had not changed its formula to determine which states and jurisdictions require federal oversight. Now, Congressman John Lewis was one of the strong supporters of the Civil Rights Act. He was very badly beaten as a very young man when he marched for the right to vote in 1965, and he was very distressed by the Supreme Court decision.
Today, the Supreme Court stuck a dagger in the heart of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. They're saying, in effect, that history cannot repeat itself, but I succumb and walk in my shoes. As Justice Ginsburg described in her dissent, the history is relevant because voting rights have been given in this country and they have been taken away. After the Civil War, slaves were given the right to vote by a constitutional amendment. They were elected to Congress and serve in this body. After a few short years later, those rights were nullified in one of the worst, most brutal periods of discrimination and human and civil rights violation followed those decisions. It took exactly 100 years from 1865 to 1965 to get those rights back. A nation turned a blind eye to legalize segregation and racial discrimination for 100 years. It took organizing people who feared for their lives. It took standing in unmovable lines. It took people struggling and dying for the right to vote.
John Lewis, congressman from Georgia. South Carolina Attorney General Scott Wilson took a very different view of the court's decision.
I'm pleased with the decision that the court took. First off, I want to state, you know, for the record, that I've always been a supporter of the Voting Rights Act. I think the Voting Rights Act was something that was created at a time in our nation's history when it was needed. I believe that the Voting Rights Act is a resounding success. You look at what it has done over the last nearly five decades, it has helped bring equal voting rights to millions of Americans, specifically those residing here in South Carolina. The one issue that I had with the Voting Rights Act, that many of us had with the Voting Rights Act, is that it has provisions in it that use election data from the 1960s, and it uses that election data to impose standards and burdens on states in the 21st century. There are some states that don't have those same burdens, but probably would have failed that test in 1965, but they're treated completely different and they're given a pass. States like South Carolina far exceed those standards of the 1960s. You know, we now have a state where we have an African-American United States senator, a female Indian governor. We have minorities and women in unprecedented levels in serving in elected office. You know, South Carolina of 2013 is not the South Carolina of 1965.
That is the Attorney General of South Carolina, Alan Wilson. Now, let's go back to the group we have here in the studio and far-flung points. First to Michael Fauntroy, who is at one of those far-flung points. Now, we just heard John Lewis talk about the terrible days of the civil rights movement, which he went through. And then we heard the relatively brand new Attorney General of South Carolina talk about a completely different experience. What do you think, Michael Fauntroy? Do you think that young people of color understand where John Lewis is coming from and his concerns about the Voting Rights Act, or do you think that it's such ancient history it doesn't mean anything to them?
Well, I wish I could tell you that they do, but sadly they don't. You know, for the previous 11 years, I taught in a graduate program at a different university, and I'm just joining the faculty at Howard. And I've been stunned at my time at George Mason University and how many students didn't have historical context from the 1990s, let alone what was going on in 1965 and before. So whether it's students of color, young people of color or not, I think that, you know, generally we need a better civics lesson, if you will, in this regard. And the South Carolina Attorney General mentioned that, you know, South Carolina is flowering in terms of its minority elected officials. And the reason for that is the Voting Rights Act. And he cannot guarantee anybody that if the Voting Rights Act were to be gutted as it has just been, that things would not regress at all. And I think that's the big concern that many people who are supportive of the Voting Rights Act and have lamented what happened in the Supreme Court decision really feel. I mean, no one can guarantee that things won't go backwards.
There have been substantial political changes. I mean, one of the most striking, of course, is the President of the United States, the first Black President of the United States. We have also seen in the last few elections enormous turnouts by Black voters and by Hispanic voters, turnouts that are so large, Ron Elving, that they have actually caused party elders on both sides to talk about new ways to reach out to these groups. So what do you think? Do you think that the political power shown by the Black community, by Hispanic voters in the last election, Does that, do you think, sort of tip the balance and make it less likely that states will go on some kind of a crusade to reinstate the bad old days?
I think you could argue that it's going to tip the balance in the other direction, that some states are going to look at the situation you've just described, rising voting behavior on the part of racial minorities, and say, what can we do to make sure that all of these people are legitimate voters, because a question is raised oftentimes in some of these states that many of these votes are being cast illegitimately, either because people aren't citizens or they're voting multiple times or what have you. So they have introduced a number of voter ID laws, a number of restrictions. Let's not have any more early voting, for example. Let's not have any more on-site registration. Let's raise the bar a little bit and make sure everybody is a legitimate voter. And certainly everybody is in favor of honest elections. Everybody wants an election to be a matter of one person, one vote, and no monkey business, no fooling around. But at the same time, when you apply these laws, it somehow seems that frequently the effect that is being sought and that is effectuated is that there is less minority voting. So if that seems to be still the impulse on a lot of these states, and not just the 16 states that are covered by preclearance, but a number of other states as well, then there would seem to be a need for something that prevents that kind of suppression activity, voter suppression activity, that is a legal and effective means of keeping that to a minimum.
So what do you think about the states that where any activity takes place that voters feel is in some way is injuring them, is unfair to them, they can still sue under the Voting Rights Act, they can bring cases against the Voting Rights Act, but they don't have preclearance. Nina, is there... What about the states?
Well, they will undoubtedly win some of those suits, but litigation is a very long and costly process. And, you know, if you're talking about a major redistricting in, for example, Texas, yes, that's going to get litigated. If you're talking about a local school board in a town that's 100,000 or 50,000 people, that may very well not get litigated. So there are going to be mixed results here. And I think one of the interesting things of the last election, and we're going to, I think the tale is yet to be told, is whether some of these efforts to suppress voter turnout, or at least to make it more difficult, will have some sort of a backlash effect. I mean, the one thing that is already you've seen efforts to cut back on early voting. Early voting doesn't involve the qualifications for any voter. It just means that people who can't get there perhaps on a weekday from between 7 in the morning and 7 at night or 6 at night have other days when they might be able to vote. And there was a real backlash to that in Florida to the point that the governor backed off in 2012. Now, I don't know whether that's going to be replicated elsewhere or not.
One thing I would say is that the Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act is like a sort of Damocles. The thing about it is that it hangs over you. That's its effect. And it hung over a lot of these states and these jurisdictions. And so they were much more careful because they knew they were going to have to justify every change to either a court in Washington or the Federal Department of Justice. Now they don't have to worry about that. They can implement a change. And if somebody has a problem with it, they're going to have to go into court and sue them, which is an expensive process, as Nina said. And so there's just going to be less care taken, I think it's fair to say, to make sure that changes don't have a retrogressive effect, that you moving the district lines won't cause a community to be split up into and its voting effect to be divided in that way.
So those states that have done things like, for example, passed or attempted to pass legislation that suggests that you have to bring identification to vote.
Well, it may depend on the state. I mean, for example, in Georgia, The Justice Department approved their voter ID law after they made some changes. The same in South Carolina after they made some changes. Texas, its voter ID law got barred, and they're already trying to reactivate it. But as I recall, and Tom, correct me if I'm wrong, when this was before a court, they thought that the voter ID law, actually, that there was evidence, that the court thought there was evidence of intentional discrimination.
That's right. Texas's redistricting its voter ID has come under attack from a lot of different directions, but it is really noteworthy, you know, within hours of this decision coming down, jurisdictions that were being subjected to preclearance review right now, everything was on hold until they got DOJ approval, said, we are moving forward. We don't have to slow down at all anymore.
Don't have to wait for preclearance. We don't. That's gone.
Yes.
So things could change, but I still, let me ask the question again, Michael Fauntroy. So much has changed. So many new voters are in the system. So many new representatives have been elected, and at the local level, mayors, city aldermen, that kind of thing. I mean, is it? It's not poised to tip back, is it? I mean, there's considerably more pressure going the other way than there once was.
Well, I think it could potentially go backwards. I mean, you know, you mentioned earlier the great turnout in 2008 and 2012, but then you look at 2010 and turn in 2006 and you see a different story. Now, some of that is political. More people get excited about presidential elections than they do off-year elections. But the reality is that with this sword of Damocles, as was mentioned a moment ago, being removed, there's nothing to stop state legislatures from chipping away and making things a bit more difficult. And before you know it, we're down the line and you see a significant downturn in terms of registration and participation. I am not as optimistic as some who seem to think that, you know, we're past the point where that can happen. I believe that it certainly could.
I want to ask Tom a question. You know, we're talking about the Supreme Court. This decision by the 5-justice court majority, written by the Chief Justice, I think that he framed it as much as he possibly could as not an attempt to denigrate what the reasons for the Voting Rights Act to begin with, but the times had changed. And I think that he thought he did the minimal he could, given his view, that he could have struck down Section 5 and said entirely, and said, he just said, look, we're just saying the formula is no good. You can go back and you can change the formula. But do you think that this, what do you think this decision will be looked at in terms of his legacy and in terms of how it will be looked at over the course of history?
Well, I think you're going to have to look at a body of work, and you have to start probably with this, a little prehistory here, and that is John Roberts brokered a compromise with the left of the court a few years ago to say to Congress, we're warning you, this is a shot across the bow, we have grave concerns about this statute, fix it so that we don't have to strike it down. And that was a very difficult compromise that fell apart just yesterday when the conservatives said, and we really, really meant this, and the left of the court said, what are you talking about? This is a foundational piece of civil rights legislation. I think that John Roberts' legacy is a really interesting one because you're going to combine it with a decision like this, which is regarded as a very aggressive conservative decision on a fundamental legal question, with something like health care last term, which we were all talking about, in which he was the essence of saving it. And so it's going to really depend. He's got another 25 years on the Supreme Court at the very least. I do think as a practical matter, he is as effective an advocate and tactician for conservative jurisprudence as you could imagine, because he's able to move the court in that direction without losing the confidence of the country. He is an artist in that way, and that is, he takes a step, but he doesn't take a leap. He takes a step, but he doesn't take a leap. And it's all in a package of decisions that also look more liberal, even if he doesn't join in them, like the DOMA case today.
Now, let's just catch up at right here at the end of our hour. One thing that we have not yet talked about, which is affirmative action. Now, that's a case where he did lead the court into a sort of a cautious compromise.
Well, we don't know if he led the court because Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion. I'm losing track at this point. I've been up a lot. Justice Kennedy wrote the court opinion, and we don't know whether it was the Chief Justice who signed on to what other justices sort of brokered or whether he actually led here. It could have just as well been Breyer who led.
Let's talk about the decision.
So we have another compromise, not unlike that decision I mentioned a few years ago. And so we have the court saying two things from Justice Kennedy, our center vote, saying point one, look, if a university here makes a judgment that it needs diversity, we're going to defer to that. And if it makes a judgment that it's going to have to use race in its decision making, well, we're going to take a much harder look at that. And what the university is going to have to show a court is you did not have another way of getting the diversity that you insist is essential. There wasn't some race-neutral mechanism. And what the court said is that a lower court in approving the University of Texas's program had just been too deferential, that strict scrutiny, which is the legal term, is really strict in fact, and they sent it back down. But what they didn't do is what we expected, which is a sweeping ruling actually narrowing affirmative action that would have been leading the NPR news, and we would have perhaps started by talking about it. And so it did put the court in the position of moving the court a step in a conservative direction with a majority that was quite broad, only Justice Ginsburg dissenting. 8 members of the court were willing to join in this compromise, but it's another compromise that's probably going to fall apart in just a few years.
Plus, they also had the prospect of a case coming next year, which they've already agreed to hear from Michigan, which is a much more frontal assault, really, on affirmative action in the Schuette versus Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action
case. That's not really an affirmative action case. It's a case about a referendum and whether or not...
That's true, but where the voters have approved
right.
a referendum against affirmative action,
it makes
a punch in the nose.
Nina, let me just give you, maybe 25 seconds to answer the question that you asked Tommy about the legacy of the Roberts Court, as we've seen some very important decisions this year.
Well, I'm not sure what the legacy of the Roberts Court will be, because part of the Roberts Court consists of justices in their 70s, even Justice Ginsburg, who's in her 80th year. And part of the Roberts Court consists of the Chief Justice, who is, I think, 57 now, and other justices who are younger than he is, and a little bit older than he is. I think we're going to have to look at his legacy, as Tommy said, 10 or 20 or 30 years from now. He's been on the court since 2005. I'm not quite there yet. I just know that, as Tom said, he's a very shrewd tactician.
I want to thank all of you, NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, our senior Washington editor Ron Elving, Michael Fauntroy, political scientist from Howard University, our business correspondent Wendy Kaufman, and Tom Goldstein of SCOTUS Blog. The special was produced by Giselle Grayson and edited by Jordana Hochman. Maureen Chowdhury was production assistant. Ned Wharton directed. Stu Rushfeld was our engineer. I'm Linda Wertheimer, and you have been listening to special coverage of the United States Supreme Court from NPR News.